Hello.
Hi, Dr. DeWall. Louis Free, welcome back to the Louis B. Free Radio Show, Brain Food from the Heartland. It's been too long since we've spoken, but I'm so honored to have you back on the show talking about this incredible book, Mama's Last Hug. Doctor, if you tell us, if you don't mind, a little bit about yourself, or a lot about yourself would be great.
Well, I'm Frans DeWall. I'm a Dutch-American primatologist who teaches at Emory University. I started my career in the Netherlands, where I did my PhD, and I studied at the time at the Arnhem Zoo chimpanzees, where Mama lives. And so Mama of the book title is someone I've known for ages, until she died in 2016. I moved to the U.S. in 1981. And have been here ever since, doing work on chimpanzees, bonobos, other primates, capuchin monkeys, and so on. And so the book is basically a summary of my experiences. I've always worked on social behavior, like conflict resolution, cooperation, empathy, and so on. And so the emotions are always involved in everything I do, but for the longest time, we were not allowed to talk about emotions, and so in this book, I've decided to open up the book and show what's going on in terms of emotions in animals.
And I'm thrilled that you did. This is just absolutely, absolutely incredible book. I'm sorry, I'm getting emotional myself because I've got the video running next to me of Mama.
Oh, okay.
And it just, I no matter how many times I see it, it just, I'm sorry, Dr. DeWall, I'm a little embarrassed. It just stirs emotion. Catherine, who
likes... Well, I can describe the video to your audience if they want.
Please.
The video has been seen by 100 million people, I think. And I took that as the starting point of the book, not only because I know Mama and know her background and so on, but also because people were very surprised by how human-like her expression of emotion is, how human-like her facial expression is, her sounds, how she embraces the professor who visits her. So Jan van Hoof was my professor, and he, at the age of 80, he visited her in her Mama in her night cage, where she was dying. And we never go in visit an adult chimpanzee because that's far too dangerous. But in this case, because she was so weakened, and since he had known her also for 40 years, so was very familiar with between the two of them, he decided to visit her to say goodbye because she was clearly at the end of her life. And she reacted by embracing him, and he reacted by embracing her. And that encounter is, of course, extremely emotional, and people are very touched by it. But people were also very surprised by how human-like chimpanzee emotions are. And that's why I took it as a starting point to explain that all the facial expressions that we have, we can find also in the chimpanzee, and probably also all the emotions that we have. I don't think there's much difference in the emotional lives of humans and the higher primates.
Again, and the result of that is this incredible book, Mama's Last Hug, Animal Emotions and What They Tell Us About Ourselves, a book, of course, available everywhere and everywhere online. Frans de Waal, Dr. Frans de Waal, the author, is my guest. You know, it makes me think of your book, Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? Are we smart enough to understand now with this work about how emotional they are? And I think because of this incredible book, we've learned so much. I've got to ask you, I love the dedication for Catherine who lights my fire. Do you mind? Do you mind?
That's an inside joke.
Okay.
Because my wife Catherine, actually, because she's French, she hits the doors, and I love the doors, and it's of course a song. Light my fire is a song. But she also lights my fire. She claims that she is better than me at setting up the fireplace. And so it's an inside joke.
Well, thank you for sharing that. That is absolutely, I had No idea. I would have never come to that and thinking that. I love when you talked about in the prologue of the book about watching behavior comes naturally to me. And you write, and I know we have limited time, but you write about telling your mom about the scene on that regional bus where you must have been 12 and you saw. I mean, this it's natural for you. Observation is now your profession, as you write. You say, don't expect me to notice the color of a dress or whether a man wears a hairpiece. Those things don't interest me in the least. Instead, I focus on emotional expressions, body language, and social dynamics. And you write, they are so similar between humans and other primates that my skill applies equally to both. Talk with me a little bit about that observational ability in that regard for you.
Yeah, so I'm a natural observer. It's only later in my career that I started doing experiments to see how animals share food or how they cooperate. But basically, what I like to do is just sit down and watch them. And I become very patient at such a time, even though normally I'm not the most patient person. But when I'm sitting in front of a bunch of primates, I become very patient and I just wait things out. And I absorb information, I think, more than most people. The only people that I know who are equally good at observation are usually bird watchers, because the bird watcher, as you may know, needs to pay attention to the tiniest details on the birds, and these people are usually very good at observation. I take in a lot of information, and I'm also very good at keeping track of multiple events at the same time. And so I'm a natural observer, and I've had students who were natural observers, and I've had also students who are much more drawn to the experiment, because in the experiments, of course, you manipulate things. There's a lot of people who like to do that much better than just sit and wait.
It takes patience, correct? It takes patience to sit and wait and see things
yes,
happen naturally.
It takes patience, and it takes sensitivity to patterns, because observation is really pattern recognition. So it's a bit like when you watch sports, and for example, I'm not used to the American sports. I've never gotten used to football and baseball and things like that. So I don't see the patterns. I can watch a football game, but I just don't understand what's going on because I'm not trained in recognizing the patterns. Whereas if I watch a soccer game, I'm so used to that, and I've played it myself, of course, that I recognize the patterns much better. And I think observation is really pattern recognition, is that you know approximately what's going to happen and you wait for the certain moments and you anticipate and all of that.
I'm talking with the incredible Dr. Franz De Waal, the new book, Mama's Last Hug, Animal Emotions and What They Tell Us About Ourselves. Again, the book available everywhere and everywhere online. You need to read. You need to read. We all need to read. This book. It was an incredible read for me. Dr. De Waal, I've got to tell you, I could spend hours with you on the prologue. I have so marked up my book is so marked up with it. I love when you wrote, we are constantly in touch with our feelings, but the tricky part is that our emotions and our feelings are not the same. And forgive me for reading your book to you, but again, talk with us a little bit about that. When someone on the surface might say, they're not, and they're not, and you explain mm-hmm. it. Will you please?
Yeah, so the feelings are private states, are internal states, and I can know your feelings, but I can only know them by what you tell me about them. So you can tell me I was sad, or you can tell me I was happy. I still don't know, it's very tricky, the feelings, because I still don't know if your happiness is like my happiness or your sadness like my sadness. So I have to make a bunch of assumptions about it. But feelings are hard to know in other humans. They're impossible to know in other species. Now, I personally think that other animals, especially other mammals, let's say your dog or a primate, I think they have similar feelings as we do. That's my assumption because their brains are so similar to our brains. But I cannot know that, and of course they don't talk about them. And in a way, I'm very happy that I work with animals who cannot talk about their feelings, because I have to work with pure observation. Now, the emotions we can measure. The emotions are visible in the face, audible in the voice. They produce odors. They produce blood pressure. They change your body. They're always affected in the body, and emotions are perfectly measurable. And so for science, the scientists became so reluctant about the emotions of animals, I think partly because they confused them with the feelings. They would say, you cannot study emotions in animals because you cannot know their feelings. And I'm trying to separate the two in the book by saying, yes, the feelings is maybe speculative, but the emotions are perfectly measurable. They are present in the behavior, and we can measure them. And so I insist on this distinction, because for science to advance with animal emotions, we need to focus on the body and how they are expressed and how they change the behavior of animals. And the feeling part, maybe we'll get to that later. Maybe the neuroscientists are going to help us at some point getting to the feeling part. That's very well possible.
Again, I've got so many things that I've got marked up, and I'm still in the prologue. I love that. I love when you write, anyone who claims to know what animals feel doesn't have science on their side. It remains a conjecture. You write, I'm all for assuming that species related to us have related feelings, but we should not overlook that the leap of faith that it asks us to take. A little bit about that, if you don't mind.
Yeah, I think with animals close to us, like the primates, my assumption is that a chimpanzee who is angry, or a chimpanzee who is jealous, or a chimpanzee who is sexually attracted to another chimpanzee, for that matter, all of them can have, I think, feelings very similar to us. It would be very strange to me to assume that animals with a body and a brain so similar to us would have different or no feelings at all. Some people assume that. Some people say you should not assume feelings in animals. I don't know why they would say such things. But so I'm all for assuming similarity, but I cannot really know that because I cannot ask the chimpanzees about it. And even if I could ask them about it and they could give me answers, I still don't know exactly if a chimp tells me I was in love. Is that the same as when I was in love? Yeah. You know, that's not really a possibility for me. And I think the same problem exists with humans, actually. There's now all this emotion research on humans, which is done by questionnaires. So you ask people, how did you feel, or why did you do this? Or I'm not sure I can trust all that information that people give you in the questionnaires. I don't trust people as much as most psychologists do, because I think people make up feelings. People have trouble describing their own feelings. People are sometimes not aware of their feelings. I think the psychologists should also go to more emotion research, where they just put people in front of a computer and present them with situations and measure their skin conductance or their blood pressure. I think that's a better way of studying human emotions than asking people questions.
From the book, Mama's Last Hug, Animal Emotions and What They Tell Us About Ourselves. We are animals, you write. Since I don't look at our own species as emotionally much different from other mammals, and in fact would be hard-pressed to pinpoint uniquely human emotions, we had better pay careful attention to the emotional background we share with our fellow travelers on this planet. And then we get into chapter one of your book, and believe me, I'm not here to do the book, but when you watch that video, and when you write about the fact of a chimps and the and how I'm going to say dangerous it is. You know, a lot of people think, well, I'd go in. Well, of course I'd go in. And when you wrote in the book, Mama's Last Hug, you say that when I asked Jan if he would have done the same thing with any other chimp at the zoo, some of whom he had known for nearly as long, he'd said, no, he's too attached to life to even think about it. Maybe we watch too many movies or too many Tarzan movies to understand,
yeah.
Right? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, the movie business is, of course, terrible, because Hollywood has presented us with all these apes in movies, and they usually dressed up and they smoke cigarettes and things like that, and people think that that's funny. And so if movie makers wanted to laugh, they would throw in a primate. These are terrible situations, because usually there's an animal trainer standing in the background with a cattle zapper or with a whip to keep the primates in line. And they usually use, if they use orangutans or chimpanzees, they use young ones, because the fully adult ones they cannot control. They're too strong and too smart also to be controlled like that. And so the movie industry has given us this image that you can sit with a chimpanzee on your lap and everyone is happy, and everything is funny.
Yeah.
But that's not how it is. A chimp is a very dangerous animal, and there's several accidents that have happened in the last 10 years with people getting too close to chimps and getting attacked. So we are always very careful in captivity. In the wild, people, of course, get closer to chimps, but the chimps there have learned to fear humans, and so they try to stay away, and in addition, they have escape opportunities. So if there is trouble, then there is room to move about, whereas in captivity, then that's not always the case.
When and it's like, you know, cornering someone, you know, putting someone in a corner with no way out. When you write about finality and grief in the book Mama's Last Hug, one of the things, and if you don't mind, just a very quick something what we've had. I've had obviously no experience with IMAs, but certainly other than reading, really I do because of reading your books. But when we had my wife and I have had a number of rescue rabbits, and they were a bonded pair. And when the one little girl when we had to have her euthanized, I felt I'd bring her body, you know, let him know, not just she didn't just disappear, let the, the male let him see her, let him do what he was going to do. You write about what happens with the chimps and how they try to, you write about wakes, and I'm trying to move myself along here. Probably humans originated wakes in the hope that their loved ones would come back to life or else make absolutely sure they were not, or she were not dead prior to burial. And you write about some of the behavior of what they do when one dies. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so when Mama died, the zoo did something that they normally zoos never do, is because normally zoos just remove the body.
Yeah.
But the zoo decided to let all the chimpanzees, expose all the chimpanzees to the body to see what they would do. And the males of the colony were not particularly interested, it seems, even though some of them dragged the body and jumped on it, which has also been observed in the wild. The thinking is that that's maybe also a way of testing if the individual is still alive, yes or no. It's maybe a bit similar to what we do in hospitals, where we also test bodies out before we decide that the person is dead. And the females, they did it in a more subtle way. They would lift up an arm of the body and then see it drop down. And they were also, I think, testing out if Mama was really dead. Even though I don't know if they fully understand what that means, but they were testing that out. And Mama had adopted a young female who was more or less had become her daughter. And that female was extremely protective of her body. That she was adult, but she was keeping everyone away, and she was screaming and yelling at them as soon as they touched it. And so even though many chimpanzees were interested in inspecting the body and testing it out, she was also very protective of it.
Again, ladies and gentlemen, you've got to read the book, Mama's Last Hug, Animal Emotions and What They Tell Us About Ourselves, Dr. Franz de Waal's book, as I always say, available everywhere and everywhere online. When you write about empathy, can you talk with us a little bit about empathy?
Yeah, empathy is a topic that I study in all sorts of animals, also in elephants and in rodents. And with the chimpanzees, the typical situation of empathy is that one of them is distressed, for example, has lost a fight, has been screaming, and others come over and kiss and embrace and calm them down. It's called consolation. Consolation in bonobos is also very common, in elephants very common. Dogs have been tested actually in human homes. People have tested dogs to see how they respond to a person who acts as if they're crying, and dogs have a very strong response, come over, put their heads in their lap, or lick their face. And so consolation behavior is an expression of empathy, but empathy is basically defined as that you're sensitive to the emotions of somebody else, and that sometimes you adopt these emotions, like if everyone is happy, you're going to be happy. If everyone is depressed and sad, you're going to be sad. And so that's emotional contagion, it's called. And I think all the mammals have that. And emotional contagion probably started with maternal care, because females need to be sensitive to the emotions of the offspring when the offspring is hungry or in danger. And so it started probably with maternal care, and that's also why females have more of it than males, usually.
Mm-hmm.
also in our species, and why oxytocin is involved. That's very much a maternal hormone. And we know from the neuroscience studies on animals that if you block the oxytocin receptors, this consolation behavior, for example, disappears. And so it is very much an empathic response, very similar to the empathy in humans.
Ladies and gentlemen, I will tell you, reading Mama's Last Hug, Animal Emotions, and what they tell us about ourselves, I smiled through a lot of it, I laughed through some of it, and I cried through much of it. But I was so educated by reading and opened my eyes to so many things in reading this incredible book. Sentience, What Animals Feel. You start this chapter with, when people ask me if I think an elephant is a conscious being, I sometimes retort, you tell me what consciousness is and I'll tell you if elephants have it. You say that usually shuts them up. No one knows exactly what we're talking about. Sentience, What Animals Feel. The entire book, incredible, but wow, what a chapter. Tell us a little bit. Talk with us about sentience, if you would.
Yes, sentience is defined as your capacity to feel something. So we usually keep it extremely simple. If we talk about sentience, we say pleasure and pain. Those are the basic things that you need to feel. And there are experiments on that. And of course, we all assume that pleasure and pain, for sure, that your average dog or cat has that. Every animal must have some of that. But there was always a debate on do fish feel pain and things like that. And in recent research, one of the studies that was done was with crabs, where they had crabs in captivity. They would shine a bright light on them, and the crabs would immediately scuttle into hiding places. They don't like bright lights. And so in some of these places, they would get electric shocks. And then they did that multiple times, and they noticed that the crabs started to avoid the places where they had been shocked. That means, the conclusion of the scientists is, that means that the crabs remember these places. They must have had painful experiences, or at least unpleasant experiences, that they remember. And so that means that crabs are sentient, because they experience pleasure and pain. And I think this is now the conclusion of all that research, is that fish and crabs and all sorts of animals, basically every animal with a brain, I would not exclude insects either, so all animals with a brain probably are sentient in the sense that they have experiences. And that has implications, it has moral implications, because sentience is often used in the moral discussion. Can we do with animals what we do with them? And as soon as animals can experience pleasure and pain, we have different obligations to them, I feel, than when they can't. So if animals are just machines, yes, you can do whatever you want with them. But if we conclude, and I think that's the conclusion at the moment, that they have emotions and probably feelings, and certainly they're sentient, then we have different obligations to them.
I like when you wrote about your Plecostomus and your clown loaches and how you see fish and how you understand that as you're talking about in sentience. I would be amiss if I didn't talk a little bit about the in sentience in the chapter Meat and Sentience, when you write about what we're doing with factory farming. And I hope you don't mind my going here, but from you, with your experience, with your education, with your observations, absolutely brilliant what you wrote about, and how that you have banished practically all mammalian meat from the family's kitchen. Talk with us a little bit about animals. Again, I know you don't have a wealth of time to talk with me about this, but the upshot of that, if you don't mind if I use that expression, what do we need to know?
Yeah, I think my ideal world would be if we cut the meat consumption in half, and the other half that we still do eat, we treat a lot better than we do nowadays. Because I'm not against meat eating. I'm too much of a biologist to question the circle of life, which I think is everywhere around us. So it's not the meat eating part for me that is a problem. It's the treatment of animals that is a problem. And in an ideal world, if it's even maybe 20 years from now or whatever, we would not even have animals. We would grow meat in petri dishes. We would we make it out of plants. We produce something that resembles meat out of plants. I think that would be the absolute ideal. But in the meantime, I think we should work on reducing the meat consumption and being a lot more aware of where the things that we do eat, where it comes from.
Your hopes, and again, I know you've got to go in a couple of minutes, Dr. DeWall, your hope from the gift to our world of Mama's Last Hug, animal emotions, and what they tell us about ourselves. What is your greatest hope from having written this book and having it so well received internationally?
Well, I think the hope is also that this will reach the humanities and philosophy and anthropology. There's entire areas in science where we deny the similarity between humans and animals, and where people like to emphasize how we humans, we are special, we are different. And I think that's ultimately a destructive attitude, because it has also given us the ecological crisis that we're living through. That crisis comes from the fact that we think that we are separate from nature, we can do with nature whatever we want. I don't think that's the case, and we are now seeing that if we do that, it has a boomerang effect that comes back to haunt us. And so I feel our whole attitude towards animals and towards nature needs to change, and so that's my hope to achieve is this kind of work.
And with you and your reputation, with your work, with the lifetime of work that you have to come to this with Mama's Last Hug, Animal Emotions, and What They Tell Us About Ourselves, is an absolutely must-read. Again, folks, I laughed at some of it, I learned from all of it, and I cried through some of it, but it is so vitally important that we all read and share this book. Franz DeWall's new book, Mama's Last Hug, available everywhere and everywhere online. And Dr. DeWall, I want to, again, my apologies. I just get so emotional from this. And it's so wonderful. Yeah. And what a gift. What a gift you've given our world.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Yep.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Franz DeWall on the Louis B. Free Radio Show, Brain Food from the Heartland. This is just an incredible, incredible book. He is a gift. He is truly a gift.